Welcome, everyone, to another special episode of this podcast that we call Brainstorm Brewery.
But is it a special episode?
It is a very, 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 very special episode.
Oh, okay.
I just, you know, if I announce that, it's going to be too special to handle. Because
wouldn't
you know,
want that.
No, you wouldn't want that. So we're here at episode 136. This is Brainstorm Brewery, the major podcast that you can find on, and you can support us on Patreon. I'm Marcel MTG. You can find me on Twitter, and that's about it. And then we got three other, you call them financial geniuses, experts in the community. If you want to know your finance, you talk to these guys, and they'll get you laced up in the game. We're going to start off with our true talent on the podcast, Ryan Bouchard.
Laced up and on your game. Man, Marcel, you are just all about it tonight already. I'm excited. This is going to be sweet.
And then we got the middle child, which is most likely, you know, the redheaded stepchild that everyone wants to shit on. But he's still the favorite of the, you know, the parents. It's Corbin Hostler.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly the image I'm trying to cultivate. Thanks.
Hey, that's what Red is trying to cultivate, right?
Yeah. We'll talk about that in a little while.
And then last and obviously least.
Sober Jason.
the talent from the other podcast that's actually turning out to be a really good podcast, Money Draft. The guy that came home from his stand-up comedian show, and he is a little bit sloshed. We got Jason Esalt.
You're lucky. You're lucky I deigned to do this podcast.
Deigned to do the podcast.
Oh, I like that. You
that was good, Marcel.
That
was
really
good.
You were on it tonight, man.
Yeah, okay.
Hey.
You're lucky I'm even here.
Yeah, because you're not wrapped around a telephone pole? Is that like what you're talking about?
I'm a man. I can still drive.
We do not advocate this. At least I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
You can have drinks and not be legally unallowed to drive.
That's correct. I'm stone sober. I don't know what these degenerates told you about my current state, but I'm totally 100% stone sober. We're not going to have another Kermanticore incident tonight.
We already had
that's,
it.
That's the driving. Yeah, it was off air.
Yeah.
No, that's Jason's driving. Like his driving force here is no, we cannot have a Kermanticore.
I think it's fine. I stand by everything I said about Kermanticore, but like that's if people don't want that, then they don't have to worry because that's not going to happen.
And if we have new fans that don't understand about this, you could find out what was it, the Born of the Gods set review.
Yeah.
Don't direct people to that.
Or you can go to episode 100.
They need to know.
They need to know.
Yeah, episode 100 is a better place to direct them. Yeah. It would be much more fun.
Because if you listen to the whole episode of the set review, they'll see the really dark side of Jason. Because episode 100 was bad, but it wasn't horrible. But when you got the whole picture, like Jason was just an asshole.
One of these days, I'm going to listen to episode 100.
Yeah,
you
one of these
days
you'll
yet?
Listen to any episode of this
Oh,
book.
You know I don't. Come on.
But you haven't listened to 100 yet?
That's of course I haven't.
Are you serious?
I've heard that, listen to 100 like once a week.
I listen to it like once a month, but yeah.
Oh, man. Corbin, that hurts me, actually.
100's really good.
It really is. Like, well, we actually did it right. I was impressed. Like, with all the time we took and put into it, it was worth it.
Well, okay, it doesn't matter. You don't want to come to Vegas. You don't want to listen to our episode 100.
Oh, my God.
Corbin, too good for Las Vegas Hostler.
Yeah, that's it.
It's just my birthday. If it were Ryan's birthday, I bet you'd come, you'd
Yeah, that's probably true.
But we gotta remind everybody, we're only 3 months out. You know, by the time you get this podcast, it's going to be a little less than 3 months. And you better get ready for Vegas because Vegas is going to be the best
Prepare
shit on the
anuses
planet.
Prepare your for Las Vegas. That almost rhymes.
Right.
Wow.
That was a stone-cold sober thing to say.
Yeah.
So you talking about Carmageddon? They had to prepare their anus for the potential lawsuits that are coming
they
in?
They hate us because they ain't us.
Wait, what are we talking about?
Oh, I read some stuff on Reddit, gasp.
Why'd you go on that website?
Mistake.
They're talking about Carmageddon, and I wanted to hear, and I guess people
I
are complaining about not being paid. Oh,
it
Carmageddon.
Was an event.
It was an event in
oh,
Vegas.
Oh, it was that one that flopped.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
the horrible flop.
Very hard.
Oh, Cardmageddon. I thought you were talking about Carmageddon. I'm like, really? All the cars on the Los
oh,
Angeles?
Yeah. That from like 2 years ago?
Yeah, man. I pay attention.
Anyways.
You're on it. So we got some exciting Magic news, right? So let's go down our
docket. It's been a big week, fellas.
We got a full docket here. Oh, my goodness. And we got some stuff that we're going to get into. There's a Twitter conversation me and Corbin had, and it's going to be a 3-on-1. They're gonna steamroll me later, so we'll save that good stuff until later.
Marcel likes those odds.
Yeah, it's nothing.
It'll be 2-1. I'm just not gonna talk. I'm gonna see the name.
Just going let us.
I'm gonna say some inflaming stuff and get Ryan involved too. Yeah, let's do it.
You don't want to get me involved in the conversation. Like, I'll just follow Jason's suit, but I won't come back.
And so we'll see what else we got here. We got let's jump into the Finance 101 then. That should be our first. So Finance 101 is going to be talking about price memory.
So we should start by explaining what that is.
So price memory is when a card will be bought and it say a spec, or it'll shoot up and it'll spike up to a different price. And when it reaches this different price, that is slower for the card to drop down to its original price. It has a price memory attached to it that people associate it. And it hovers at this certain price point.
I actually don't like the term price memory, because there are two simultaneous phenomena going on that kind of explain this. The first one is inherent stickiness. And I'll take this first point about stickiness. Stickiness is, nobody is in a huge race necessarily to sell the stuff at like a drastically lower price that's close to the price they paid. Now, you've heard the phrase a race to the bottom, where people are sort of like undercutting each other by a few cents to be the cheapest on TCG player to sell. But no one's undercutting by each other by $3. So if a card goes from like $4 to $11, no one's like, oh, screw it, I'll sell it for $6. You know, everyone's going to try to sell it for around $10. And if someone lowers the price to $9.50, okay, that's fine. But the stickiness of prices means that people aren't in a huge hurry to start selling it for close to $4, which is what they paid before it spiked. So the price is going to stay closer to its spike price than it is to its pre-spike price, just because nobody wants to lose money by selling for the pre-spike price. So the price is going to stay, you know, relatively high, and it's going to be really slow for the price to tick down. That's one of the aspects of the price memory.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly true. You know, when we talk about price memory, we mean a lot of times, you think about Shocklands, to give a recent example, the Shocklands now, the new ones from Ravnica the Block. Everyone kind of thinks, oh, they're $10. You know, some of them maybe a few dollars more, some maybe a few dollars less, but in everyone's mind, it's like, oh, they're $10. So, you know, a year down the road here, they may kind of move up to 15. Some of them may fall off a little, whatever. But everyone will still kind of be like, oh, they're $10, just because that's what they were at for so long. And for a long way, Jace the Mind Sculptor was like that, where it's just like, and it's kind of back there. Now it's like, oh, well, Jace is $100. That's just the way it is. So I think that's a lot of it when people talk about that. It's just that's what they mean.
What was the second point, Jason?
Well, that exactly what Corbin said.
Okay.
There's stickiness, but then there's like the reluctance to accept a new price if a price established itself just by virtue of being the price for a long time. So, like, you know, when people talk about price memory, a lot of what they're talking about is what Corbin talked about. But to an extent, stickiness actually is a factor, too, that isn't discussed a lot. So I thought I would bring that up as well.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, what do you got to input on this subject?
I mean, that's pretty much it. There really isn't like a whole lot to add to that subject in general. Like, it's pretty self-explanatory once a price stays for so long. And it's especially important to note that the cards that this typically happens to are the format staples. This isn't something where, like, I guess what I'm talking about is like your sideboard cards and stuff like that, even if their price has stayed stagnant forever, people have to look those cards up because they never went through the effort to look them up before. But the cards that people were constantly looking up while they were in standard and stuff, those are the cards that really have these kind of points that you want to watch for.
And like what it matters, I guess, going back to the Shockland discussion, and this may not be an extremely salient point right now, but say that like Steam Vents right now is a more expensive shock. It's like $12 or $13 or whatever, or some of the others maybe like $7 or $8. So, but in people's mind, they're just like, oh, it's a shock for a shock. You know, they're all around $10. And that's a trade that you just need to be aware of rather than just thinking about, just, you know, going with that price memory of, oh, these are all current around this point, because you can actually, you know, be giving up some amount of value there just by not thinking it through and just relying on your memory rather than taking the time to look at it.
So as much as it's comforting to not have to look stuff up on your phone, I would say if you're going to go out in training or you're going to go to FNM, just kind of look some of that stuff up. Kind of be forearmed with that knowledge. That would be like the best way we can tell our listeners to be aware and to benefit from price memory, is to just don't be complacent. Kind of some prices change. Like the temples kind of like aren't the same price because of playability. The shocks aren't all the same price because of playability. The fetches aren't all the same price just because of their relative playability within standard and modern and all the formats they're playing in. So just kind of be aware of what's kind of up in a given week. And if people want to trade straight across, you can absolutely use that to your advantage, because you aren't necessarily trading for stuff you need. You're trading for stuff that's, you know, on the uptick and getting rid of stuff that's on the downtick. So just be aware of that.
Awesome. There you go. You got your price memory. Put that into your magic notebook. Write that down. You know, store that in your memory banks, because you're going to be using that for quite some time. It's good to know about it. So let's move on. I've got to move on to a shout-out. Midcast shout-outs.
Of course you do.
Well, first off, I got to shout out Raging Gumby from Heavy Meta. He was in the finals of SCGLA with the Brew, actually, playing with Mastery of the Unseen, Naya type of deck. He almost got there, but he got mono screwed. But yeah, that's quite an accomplishment. And then also there's a community shout out, Mike Linneman. If you guys would have came out to Portland, did you get to meet him, Corbin, when you were out there?
Yeah, we hung out.
He was there for the B Dubs, yes.
Oh God, yeah, that time that he wanted B Dubs and drove me there, and they screwed the order up 12 different ways. Yeah, that was a fun night.
Exactly. So he came together with he set out a vote for a lot of people on Gathering Magic, and it was called the Community Top 8, which is basically people within the community that they wanted to give a shout out to for their efforts and, you know, building the community. Kind of like, you know, the Community Cup in a way, but just more of a grassroots style shout out. So they, you know, of course, our brother, the podcast, Maddie Studios, he got on there. So for the SVU. And then we also got the proxy guy, Eric Freitag from Puka Trade, along with, Tolarian Academy and Q2.
Tolarian Community College.
Sorry.
quite an academy.
Well, close enough. And then Cube Tutor, which I'm actually a fan of their website, so that was good that he got a shout out. Along with Magic Blogs DE, what's that, from Germany?
Mm-hmm.
And Iron Chef Nick, and I know it's about time he got some good shout outs. And then last but not least, we got Original Art Magic Joshua Kraus. And he was actually a fan of the podcast. He hit me up and let me know about that. He had a question for us. He wanted to know. He deals with original magic art, and he has a, you know, working on that whole thing. He's trying to get the original art community building up and getting awareness as far as how connecting people with artwork and finding, you know, collectors and stuff. But he wanted to know from us, what is your holy grail of magic art? If you could get an original piece of artwork, what would you want to get that you would, you know, frame, put up in your house or something?
Bird's Paradise.
Which one?
Bird's Paradise. Oh, like the Mark Poole one. What I like most about Birds of Paradise is the story behind it. So they originally commissioned Mark Poole to do Tropical Island. And so he drew an island, and then he wasn't done. He was like, oh, how do I show this island's tropical? I know. I'll show some tropical birds flying around it. So he submitted the art that ended up being Birds of Paradise. And I'm like, dude, we can't use this. This looks like the birds are in the front of the picture. This doesn't really showcase the island. It showcases the birds. He's like, oh, well, what do you want to do? I drew the art. You got to pay me. So they're like, yeah, we got to pay him. Why don't we just use this art? So they invented the card Birds of Paradise because they had to pay for the art they commissioned. They had Jesper Meforce do a different tropical island. That's the one they used. And they used Mark Poole's original tropical island art for Birds of Paradise. And that's I just love that story so much. And that's why I love, you know, the card Birds of Paradise. And I'm, you know, I'm a big fan of Mark Poole and his art and everything he did for the game really early on. So I mean, that's my favorite card. The original Mark Poole art, I think, is the best. It's never been in foil, but that's, you know, that's whatever. So that's the one art, if I could get framed, that's the one I would have.
That's actually really cool. I did not know that story.
Mine's a little more obscure. It's not quite like as popular of a card. It's just an art that like I've always, for some reason, ever since I've seen it, found beautiful. But the card is a bulk common from Saviors of Kamigawa. It's called Death of a Thousand Stings. The art for that card is absolutely gorgeous, especially in foil and stuff. And I mean, there's no real particular rhyme or reason to it. I just really enjoy that card. So that'd be mine.
That's pretty cool. Mine is, it's Island number 291. It's from Ravnica. It's the one where there's like domes in the background with a waterfall in the front and waterfalls in the foreground, like a little lake. And the reason it is because when I first started writing about Magic, you know, I didn't have a mugshot or anything like that. So it was just like, oh, we'll pick some card art you like and we'll use it. And I was just kind of floating around the like wallpapers that the mothership had up and came across this. And I was like, whatever, this is cool. I'll go with it. And, you know, obviously that small column 5 years ago turned into, you know, a pretty long running thing for me. So it became pretty cool to me. And, you know, now I have like a mugshot for my art and all of that. So it's just kind of forgotten about, but it's really awesome that, you know, I kind of look at it and can remember all of that. So it's also the island that I have all in foil in my Merfolk deck in Modern, because it's cooler. You know, that means a little more than having something like, you know, a Zendikar foil or anything that typically is cool like that.
Huh. I like that. This is interesting. You get to see
what about you, Marcel?
I would go for Descendant's Path. I just really like the artwork. Okay. Therese Nelson. It's similar. Looking at what Ryan's The Death of the Thousand Stings, that kind of has the same kind of complexity to it and different things that you got to look at all over the card art. And Descendant's Path, this looks like a story in there. And I still can't quite figure out exactly what's going on, which I think is a good thing.
You know,
thing
I want to say she either was interviewed or she did. I feel like if you do a little research, there's something she kind of, it was probably an interview where she talked about the background behind that card. So I think there's actually some literature out there.
Well, I mean, yeah, I read that, but I think there's still a story behind that. That's like, when you look at the card, you see that part, but there's more to it than just that. Like, you know how artists will have some hidden meaning or whatnot. To me, it seems,
I think that art is better than the card it's on, and that card's actually not bad.
Yeah, the card's not that bad. Yeah, and the art's amazing. She's a great artist. The Mother of Ruins she's done recently is just good stuff. I bought a lot of her prints. She had a sale during Christmas, so I was able to buy a good number of her prints for a good price. So I got those hanging up on my wall of awesome with other stuff up there. So.
Yeah, we're lucky to have had her because, you know, artists kind of come and go, and she's kind of been around forever. So we're lucky to have her still associated with our community after all these years.
We got some good Magic artists. I will say that. There's a lot of this art, especially nowadays. Like, the art nowadays compared to the old one, even though I'm a fan of old art, I love the old art, old border cards by far more than anything, but there's a lot of new stuff. It's just, the art direction has been just stellar. I really, you know, it's really definitely a strong point of where Magic is and, you know, its imaging. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out into, like, you know, the Magic movie. Because I think, you know, the brand identity is very strong, and they got strong characters to build from and images that I think, you know, it'll be at least very visually pleasing. And I think there's enough opportunity for the story to be developed because the Vorthos is strong in Magic, if Ryan can contest to that.
Yeah, I mean, it drew me in. So there's definitely just, I mean, there's so many different storylines to Magic now that no matter what you like, you can probably find some era, some plane, some storyline in Magic that interests you. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that we're past that, I will just note the hashtag things that Marcel says. If Ryan can contest to that.
I know. A test, right?
Yes, that would be correct.
Yeah. I just keep rolling. I know I fuck up, but it's better to roll than to try to correct yourself.
Oh, nobody noticed that.
No, they do. Now I'm hyper aware of every time I fuck up. It's like, oh.
So this is going on Twitter.
Yep, it's going. It's there. It's out there. Who cares? Yeah. Like someone did the guy from, what was that, the Trailer Boys or Jersey Boys or
Trailer Park Boys?
Yeah, is it Gregisms or something?
Oh, Rickyisms.
Rickyisms, yeah.
Yeah, Ricky from Trailer Park Boys is a. Yeah, he's a great character.
Oh, I thought I was bad. He takes it to the next step. So, let's see. Me and Ryan, we were talking earlier, and I think he has an interesting story, and he thought he didn't have an interesting story. And I think it is
a good story, Ryan. Don't try to downplay it.
It's not a good story.
It's not a story. It's more of an experience. So a lot of people don't see this side of the Magic game. You dipped out of Magic. You know, people say like you're not as involved in the market. You even say so yourself that you're not paying attention as much because you found a segment of MTG Finance that's working for you, and you found it to be, you know, a joy and a passion for you where you're spending a lot of time. So I think that a lot of people don't get to see this side of it, and I think you'll have a unique, you know, outlook and perspective that some people will never be able to see. So, you know, it's kind of like behind the scenes, the way things work, bulk cards. Let us know about it, Ryan.
I mean, so I guess like what Marcel's discussing is earlier, we were talking about like what I do for a living and kind of how it's different than necessarily, you know, people treating this as a hobby or people going out and buying collections. And like, though I do a lot of that, a lot of what I do is I work with stores and I go out and based on commission, I go and take all the stuff they've had in back rooms, back stock, whatever it may be. I process all that stuff for these like 3 cent, 5 cent, 10 cent and up cards. And I do it on like just this huge scale that makes it all efficient to do, because picking a 3 cent card, as Corbin can attest to, is not actually something that's
profitable. It's not worth your time. Yeah, I don't waste my time.
Unless you're filling 3 to 4 lists with 20 to 100 quantity on each list, and suddenly it becomes worth doing if you can do that if you can fill every quantity of every card in a lot of these sets. And so like that's really what I've found. It's just me and one guy who work here. He works for me part-time, but yeah, it's not as exciting as it sounds. I don't know, like, it's not Magic Finance as to what people think it is. That's why, like, when I see a lot of these prices and stuff, I still keep up with this stuff, but like really between me playing Standard and me doing the business end of it, I don't really care. Like, it doesn't impact me and my finance realm at all. And so, like, when a modern card spikes or some EDH foil goes up, like, all it is to me is when I find it in bulk later on, cool, it's worth that much more or that much less. But, like, Magic Finance is exactly how much and what you put into it. And it can mean exactly that as well. Like, for Corbin, it matters a lot more how standard prices are, when things are going to drop, when they're going to rotate and stuff like that, because he's got a store, he's got a case and all this stuff. Same thing with Jason. For me, that stuff doesn't really impact me. So I've just kind of found a place that really has a lot of sheltered prices, because like bulk prices don't move. Even with reprints, you'd think a lot of commons on commons would just tank, and they do, but it's such a small percentage of the commons on commons that are out there in collections in general, you don't even notice it. And for just as many that go down like that every quarter, you have just as many that all of a sudden pop up on buy lists that haven't been there before or shoot up from their current price.
So what's your picking process?
So it's one of those things, too. People ask me, like, oh, what do you base what your picks off of? And honestly, 15 years, 20 years worth of playing and looking at every Magic card and looking at buy lists for, you know, 15 of those years. It's just a matter of, and I still have the problem now, like Cody yells at me every once in a while. I pick cards that are no longer picks, because 5 years ago it was a sweet card. It was 75 cents to a dollar on buy list, but it's been printed so many times now, it's just not a pick anymore. So there's no real perfect process to it, because there's constantly cards that go on or off buy list based on different factors. And you can't really predict all of them, nor do you want to, because it's a 3 cent card. It's a 5 cent card. So what I end up doing is typically just pick through everything. Whenever a new set comes out, I usually go through the spoiler a separate time, and I go through it in a very different manner than most people do for MTG Finance. I go through and look at all the commons on commons, and I base them on what I call a 5-year out. So if I believe that that card will hold merit and will be worth something in 5 years, I'm going to pick it. And it creates a lot of backstock, but I'm seeing things now, even from like Return to Ravnica already, that I have 100, 200 copies of in stock and suddenly are popping up on buy lists. So like once you're that far into business, you have to start planning kind of for that future.
So Ryan, a question on that for people at home who, you know, obviously don't have the same scale but are interested in doing that. I mean, how do you identify those cards? Like, you know, what in Return to Ravnica did you look at and say, you know, this is something that I think will be good down the line?
So RTR is a little crazy because typically one of the things I look for, and this is a good example of like why you kind of have to be careful with it. One thing I look for is token producers. Typically anything that produces tokens, especially something like a squirrel token, is going to be insanely popular down the road. It's going to be worth money. It is very rare that you see something that produces a token that isn't worth 5 cents, 10 cents on the buy list. That doesn't seem like much to somebody, but I mean, again, when you have 100, 200, you know, plus copies of it,
it adds up very quickly.
It does. And so you kind of have to look at it not only in context of a particular set of rules that you create for yourself or that you believe, you know, is correct, but you also have to look at it in context of the set. Obviously, there's a lot more things in that set that produce tokens than in the average set. So some of them are not necessarily going to be worth money because that's just the way the world works. There still has to be value spread across the set. Otherwise, you end up, I mean, with these out-of-print sets, yeah, there are some, like you have your Shadow Moors and stuff like that that become worth a ton for the commons, uncommons, but it's not all that common that that happens. So for the most part, usually in most sets, you're going to have about a 10 to 15% like retention rate of cards that are going to be constantly on the buy list. You're going to have a 5% like waiver that will like bounce back and forth based on like a good example of that would be Guild Gates. Like they're not always on the buy list, but I consistently always pick them because they're on often enough that I can sell them when they do pop up. But yeah, there's no set of rules. And that's why I said, like, I think most people are going to find this boring because it's just something where you legitimately have to do it for so many years. And it kind of goes back to, there was a question on the MTG Finance group on Facebook, which I know some of us have our feelings about, but, they kind of asked, you know, what does it take to like make it in Magic Finance? And like, there's all these different levels to it. And that's really what it is about finding that thing that you're good at and that you can excel at. Don't try and necessarily do what somebody else is doing, because like if somebody else tried to copy what I was doing and you get too many people doing this, like you're really all just starting to compete. But there's plenty of other puzzle pieces that kind of fit into this. There's plenty of other niches that need to be filled. I mean, I could think of a half a dozen different jobs that if somebody could do right now, I would absolutely hire them on for like, you know, part-time work and stuff like that. And so just find what you enjoy and find what you love about this business if you really want to treat it as such. If you're looking
we're
to just
leave... leaving 10% for the next guy. Somebody's got to be the next guy.
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly kind of what I did. It's like I started going to these local shops and noticing that, you know, like nobody wants to mess with bulk. And like it's hard to move bulk, and it really is. And so what I've done is just created this essential model that lets me take all this bulk. Whatever I pay for it, I'm going to get back out all in picks. So really, I'm just kind of like stashing all of this bulk away, and then when I can finally sell it, like that's going to be a huge return there. But I'm willing to process enough cards, and I have the skill to do it quick enough that it makes it efficient. But it's not something for everybody. I mean, like we've all said in the past, like picking these 3 cent and 5 cent cards is difficult for me to say that that's what I do, because it is, but it's on such a different scale that it's not efficient for the majority of people.
Right. Like, I mean, for instance, I just don't mess with that stuff. If it's for me, like not doing, because I know when I'm picking something, I'm not going through as many cards as Ryan. So I'm going to find maybe two or three of that nickel card. And at some point it really does become hardish to make it worth your time. But when you're pulling 50 of the nickel card, well, then all of a sudden it's a different equation. So it all kind of depends on what your, you know, what your position is in the game.
Right. And I mean, a big part of that too is know your personal limitations. If you cannot set, sort, and alphabetize quickly, do not pick 100 different cards in a set. Pick the 10 cards, the 20 cards, the 40 cards, whatever it is that are actually worth quite a bit of money, and call it good. If you're someone who can set, sort, and alphabetize especially quick, then go ahead and pick those 5 cent cards. It may be more efficient. It's really just about how much time you're putting in versus how much you're getting out of it.
If you're shipping to somebody like Ryan and you tell them you've got semi-picked bulk, they may pay more than like the $5 per thousand on it.
Bah.
Not Ryan specific.
Yeah, you're a funny guy. I was gonna say I don't even pay for bulk anymore, man. I just do it with these stores so much now that
Well, I mean, not everybody has three stores that are too lazy to pick their own bulk.
it's not even a too lazy thing, though. It's that 10%, right? Like, look at it from the store's perspective. They don't know enough to go through it. Like, they have, like, maybe, what, one or two people in any particular store that are magic experts. Typically, their time is spent pricing things in the case, is spent helping behind the counter, is spent running F&Ms, running pre-releases. Like, when in there are they going to find time to pick all these cards, especially if they don't know the cards the way that, like, I mean, we take it for granted because we do magic finance. Most people don't know all the commons, uncommons out of a lot of these sets, and it would cost them a lot more to have somebody sit there and look up every single one of these cards for what's worth money than it would just to lose 50% and give it to me to do. Exactly. And then it also gets it out of their back room. They have a stat, they just have a essentially a paycheck that comes to them, and they get a bunch of free space. Honestly, every store that I've worked with really appreciates the service, and on top of that, it's something that I think I can expand and spread to a lot of other area stores. And I'm not just looking at Lansing. Like, I'm looking to start, as of about a month from now, start expanding this to other states as well. So,
yeah, I mean, I can vouch from that from the store, and I don't want to mess with and I get to take it home and do it. If I was just a random store employee who wasn't getting paid any different for picking the bulk, it's just not worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I can process on average without breaking a sweat in a week. I move 100,000 cards. That's just my very average, nothing crazy happened week. And most stores don't see 100,000 cards a month or, you know, every other month. And so for them to be able to keep up with it on the rate I do, it's like they just can't do it. And so if they want to be able to keep buying in collections, it makes more sense for them to quickly get that capital back than to have to hopefully let it accumulate and then spend a week or something at some point to go through and pick it and hope that it was profitable enough for them. It's better for them to take the guaranteed cash.
Man, you were upset that and thought this was going to be boring, and I think
most
great.
People are going to find it boring. And I think
what it is you think that people need to walk away with something that's going to be useful for them to use in their life right now, and that's not going to be the case for this. For most people are not going to be at this level, but the story and this hearing this perspective to me, I'm chewing this up, and I'm sure there's other people that they're having a good time. So
I guess. Well, I also just don't want to. I feel like, since I started writing and since I started this podcast, like, my kind of what I've been doing has gotten very different. Like, when I first started this podcast, I was pretty much just a backpack grinder. Like, I didn't have all these store connections. I mean, I had all the connections abroad and stuff, but I was nowhere near where I am now. I mean, these past 3 years, I've looked back the other day and just realized, like, how much my business has grown and how many more cards I am processing. And it's not, I don't know, like, I feel like I'm kind of losing touch with some of the magic community, because, like, everyone cares about, you know, what's the new hot tech and modern, what's, you know, is this card going to go up $5, is this card going to go down $5, and I just don't care. Like, the reality of the real magic finance, if you want to talk about the people who are really into magic finance, they don't give a shit about buyouts, they don't give a shit about a $5 card, they don't give a shit about a $10 card. They're either working at dual lands and working that kind of stuff, or they have their own, you know, they have their own found niche. They're, like, the people who want to say that they're in magic finance just are getting to the point where they're annoying me, because it's going to be such a big crowd. And every person who buys out something on TCG Player wants to claim they're MTG financier. That's just not the reality.
Could sound a little more elitist, but not much.
No, I mean, and it's fine.
I think that was well said.
I mean, it's fine. If they think I'm an elitist, that's cool. But the reality is I bring home my sole paycheck doing this. And I've done this for years, and I'm good at it. And I think that a lot of people think that just because you can take some capital and throw it at magic, that makes you good at it. And that's not the reality. I've watched plenty of businesses crumble with that exact model. It doesn't work.
Got to have a skill set. There's an actual trade involved here, per se.
Yeah. Well, and it's all about not burning bridges and connections. So,
So let's, on that note, we're talking about the secondary market here. Let's move into the big Twitter discussion we teased earlier.
Ding, 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 ding. Let's go.
Yeah, you and Marcel can do this.
Yeah.
I'll set this one out.
I don't want to participate in this.
Right.
Well, I think, honestly, I don't even know if we would have brought up on the cast unless we were specifically requested from several different people to talk about it. Okay, so to introduce this week on my article for People, I wrote about the dangers of counterfeits. You know, this is the counterfeits from China. This is something that pops up across social media every month, every 2 months as a new batch comes in, blah, blah, blah. And they get, you know, kind of the gist of it is the fakes are getting pretty good. It's hard to tell. So it seems like unfailingly every time a conversation comes up about counterfeits, it always leads back to people saying, well, counterfeits aren't the problem. The reserve list is the problem. If the reserve list didn't exist, nobody would do counterfeits. So, and they, because of this, it creates the justification, the belief that, oh, the counterfeits are okay. They're making these counterfeits. It's okay if we buy them because that's going to force Wizards to abolish the reserve list. Or it's okay if I just use these counterfeits for my cube because I'm not costing anyone money. Or Wizards wouldn't get this money. It would only go to some greedy corporation like Star City. So what I wanted to do was break down some of the fallacies here, which is, one, that counterfeits are illegal. Wizards of the Coast, Richard Garfield, these are the people who created Magic. They may make some poor decisions sometimes, like Modo version 4, but they are their decisions to make because Magic is their intellectual property. It's not the intellectual property of people in China with a printing press who are breaking laws to decide that we need to reprint this card. That's just not how it works. If you play Magic, you accept that Wizards of the Coast owns Magic. They get to make the decisions. If you want to play Magic, you accept that these cards that they print are the cards that they print. When you buy cards from Star City, Star City uses that money to put on opens, to produce content on their website, all these things that people like. When you support this notion that counterfeits are okay because they're going to somehow bring prices down, you need to also realize that it's not just prices on reserve list cards that are being counterfeited. They're counterfeiting $10 cards. There are Khans of Tarkir fetch lands that are counterfeits. So don't conflate the two subjects that abolishing the reserve list will stop our counterfeits, because it won't. It will not stop the criminals from doing what they want to do, which is to make money. They don't care if Magic long term suffers because the price, you lose market confidence. There's fakes out there. You don't know what's real fake. The price drops down on everything. That's not what they care about. They only care about making money. So that's my, you know, that is my stance on it, Marcel. I know obviously we vary a little bit.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I think counterfeits are horrible for the game. And I think that's the problem with arguing on Twitter, because people read things in a certain direction and it just gets not spoken out. And I think there's a lot missed in verbal communication. Yeah, I do not agree with counterfeits whatsoever. I don't think that they are good for the game. I think they're bad for the game. And it's going to be a matter of time when the counterfeits hit the point where they're going to be indistinguishable from Magic cards. That's the dangerous point. Yes, I agree that's dangerous. That's really bad for Magic. We don't want to get to that point. Yes, abolishing the reserve list won't end counterfeits. Counterfeits will be around even for $10 cards. You know, what was the Guardian? David Linneman, he had a interview with a guy that said he's doing counterfeits, and he's like, you know, he'll do a set for X amount of dollars. I forgot what it was. And people will buy that. So, of course, that's going to be eroding for Wizards. That's going to be a bad thing. But the fact and the matter is, this is just because it's illegal, just because it's bad, just because it's morally wrong to do counterfeits, doesn't mean that it's going to stop people from doing that. And honestly, the biggest problem to that is the price barrier. People don't have money like this. Like Magic is a rich man's game. For someone out there making, you know, $8.25 an hour and trying to support a family or, you know, do whatever they got to live and then try to fit Magic in there, and you look at the price of these cards that are hundreds of dollars, some people just want to play the game.
What cards in Standard are hundreds of dollars?
I'm not talking about Standard.
Exactly. Like, should everybody get to play every single fucking format just because they want to?
No, that's...
If you can't afford Vintage because you haven't been playing since the 1990s, that's too bad.
Okay, in five, ten years, you
can't play Legacy, that's... You can play fucking
Jason,
40 formats.
Let him finish.
I'm just so sick of this goddamn argument
all right. That's an elitist attitude towards it. People want a game.
No, it's not, because everyone can't have everything all the time.
Okay,
and this is born for people wanting everything.
You can't tell that to some
I don't
of these
play
people.
Vintage either, because I can't afford it, and
I understand, Jason, but you're a finance person, so you're involved in Magic. There's people that are not entrenched in Magic. There's people that may want to try out some stuff. And for them to see a deck, even a $300 deck, $300 into a game, Like, you know, that's pretty insane. You could buy a PlayStation for that price. Like,
right. So, Marcel, I guess, so what is your point? Like, what do you think needs to change? What do you think is going on here?
Well,
like,
I mean, aggressive reprints is one thing that needs to happen. When you got a $200 Tarmogoyf, and that's a cost barrier to enter into modern, then you need to get more aggressive with the reprints. Reprints are not nearly coming out like they need to. And it needs to be an acceptance within the Magic community that prices are pretty high and that Wizards needs to be able to stabilize some of these prices and drop them. And there needs to be an acceptance that, you know, maybe the era of the $200 card, the $40 card, you know, just expensive land bases just needs to stop. Magic needs to come down in costs so that the average player can jump in here and the game can grow at a greater pace.
Okay, Marcel, like you said it there, at a greater pace. The game is growing. Like, what they're doing works. I'm not talking about, like, one, I think, and you did this, you bring up Tarmogoyfic. We need to separate the reserve list conversation from the counterfeit / proxy conversation because they're different things. But, like, on the other hand, what can Wizards do? They reprint these cards. They did Modern Masters 1 with the intent to bring down prices while also keeping in mind that the last time they did a set of mass reprints, it almost destroyed the game. So, like,
that was when the game couldn't handle it.
Right, and, but they didn't know that, right? So they made Modern Masters 1.
Yeah, I understand that, but right, I agree. They're trying, but given the pace, people aren't going to be wait for Wizards to try, continue to try. So while Wizards is trying to make these reprints, some people are just going to go out and buy some cheap cars counterfeits. And, like, there's nothing you could do about that. Sure, that's going to happen. But
well, my issue is that when this comes up, and people say counterfeits are bad, the first thing out of many people's mouths is not counterfeits are bad, it's wrong, we shouldn't do it. It's the reserve list sucks. If this helps them get rid of the reserve list, then that's what happens.
See, that is the wrong attitude. But because of counterfeits, they should probably revisit the reserve list, honestly.
That's not – you can't appease the criminals,
but
man.
But it's not to the crim – it's not to –
They're reprinting. They're reprinting. People are – there's $10 cards that are counterfeit.
It's in general for the good of the game.
They can't. If you think knows it's good for the game, they can't change it.
Buying counterfeit standard cards. What is the fuck does the reserve list have to do with that?
It's like this: people that are going to play Kitchen Table, they're going to play EDH cards. If they find out about these dual lands, and then they look at the price of dual lands, and they want to have a dual land in their EDH deck, and they can figure out, oh, I could get this counterfeit for this little price. You think they're going to give a fuck? They're just going to buy that. They're going to buy that dual land for there. Eventually, you know. Kitchen Table people will find out about these cars, these reserve list cars, and they can find out the price of them. And if they could get the cheaper option, they'll go after it. So, like, I'm not saying to appease this, but I do think that the reserve list is, that's one thing that's going to create, because of the reserve list, it's going to create a greater demand for these cars, which results in someone through the black market is going to circumvent this and fulfill the need. It's
right.
Going to
so
happen.
I would say this. I don't think you're wrong. I just think that it doesn't – like the reserve list is what it is. I don't know how many times they have to say that it's not going anywhere for people to accept that it's not going anywhere.
But then
– nobody likes it. Nobody – Wizards doesn't like it, but it's a fact.
But then it's going to create a greater demand and counterfeits are going to fill that demand.
But the point is like there's always going to be a demand.
They're not counterfeiting – the majority of the cards they're counterfeiting aren't on the reserve list, so that argument is completely facile. So I don't even know why we have to have it every few months.
It's not facile. You can, like, I don't counterfeit, but I got some proxies. I got proxy power or moxes, and I got proxy dual lands for my queue. There's no way in hell I'm gonna buy some dual lands for whatever the fuck the price is right now. It's just not gonna happen.
But that is Wizard, right? And that is Wizard's choice.
You
that is Wizard's choice as a company because it's their intellectual property.
Exactly.
If they want to reprint them, they can reprint them. That doesn't mean you turn to buy something that's illegal.
I'm not buying counterfeits, but I got some proxies, and I'm not going to buy a dual land. So I'm finding a way. So in a way, it's
then don't proxies, then you don't get to play in the sanctioned legacy event.
I'm not.
With
I'm playing
proxies.
Cube. I'm playing Cube. I don't care. I'm just playing.
Yeah, well,
Cube.
That's a totally different argument than I can buy counterfeits and play in a sanctioned legacy event.
I never said that. I never. That
well,
was never. That was never. A point.
That's the whole point of counterfeiting.
Now, see, that's the problem with counterfeits is that they're trying to pass them off as real Magic cards, which is very bad for the game, which will people have no, you know, they can't tell the difference between a counterfeit and a real car, then it's going to cause a distress with people buying and selling cars, and it's going to be very, the ripple effect will be astounding when it gets to that point. But
right.
But there's a point where people want to proxy and not buy magic cars, you know, reserveless cars. Now, by people doing that, you're creating, there's a culture developing that people, like you were saying, the acceptance of, in your article, Carbon, the acceptance of, you know, counterfeits being okay by the community. I don't want to say proxies are going to lead to that, but in a way, you know, I'm not going to buy a dual land. So where's the behavior different from me buying a counterfeit?
Lots of people. Okay, so like I for one, I differentiate proxies and counterfeits in the sense that if you make a proxy and you want to use it in your cube and it's clearly a proxy, that's fine. The problem with counterfeits is not – okay, one is that you're paying for them, right? So – and two, that those cards are not made with the purpose of being proxies. They are made with the purpose of impersonating magic cards for deception. Like, to me, there's a difference between you proxying something and somebody purchasing a counterfeit card.
I understand. So what if somebody, we understand this fact. What I'm saying is, but the act of it is still not participating in magic cards.
My problem is not with the act of proxying or anything like that. My problem is with the attitude of the community that counterfeits are okay because we hate the reserve list. That's how it becomes accepted if people have that attitude. And it becomes an okay thing. And that has very real consequences for the market. People don't understand how important the secondary market is to Magic. All those articles you like to read on Star City and Channel Fireball, those exist because people buy cards from them. People do buy duels for their cubes rather than proxying them or rather than buying counterfeits. And that is important. All of these things don't exist unless the secondary market does well. It doesn't matter if that money would directly go to Wizards or not, because Star City and Channel Fireball doing well means that more people are going to play Magic, and that's good for Wizards. And Wizards making a great card game is good for Channel Fireball and Star City because they have something, you know, to build their business on. It's all tied together, and counterfeits destroy that. And to me, this doesn't seem controversial. This seems like it's literally common sense because counterfeits have been shown to damage markets. Like, that's an economic fact. And yet the community is so busy trying to get into the circle jerk of we hate the reserve lists that they're willing to accept this. They're willing to accept the counterfeits because they might achieve something for them. And I mean, it's also a fact that people are inherently more interested in their own short-term interests than they are in the long-term health of the game. So like this is what I want to get across to people, that you need to separate those conversations, because leading to the acceptance of counterfeits because you think they're going to have some effect on the game that you like is not the right attitude. It will damage the game long term. And when I wrote the article, that's all I wanted to do, was enunciate the things that can happen if this, you know, we're a long way from counterfeits ruining the game. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But if the counterfeits become indistinguishable and people aren't vigilant, people don't take it upon themselves to not allow counterfeits in their store, speak up when people see it, things like that. If the popular opinion is, oh, this is okay because this might make Wizards do something we like, rather than, I want Wizards to do this, but you cannot counterfeit, that's still wrong no matter how much a dual land costs. That's the attitude that I hope to change.
That's fair. I agree with you. So let's move on.
Pick of the week.
It's time for the pick of the week.
All right, you have a pick of the week?
I do.
Do you? That's great. I fucking don't.
No pick of the week for Jason. Who wants to go first?
You. You got one.
Okay. My pick of the week this week is Scourge of the Throne. It's a mythic from Conspiracy. The most important thing I think about this card is that it's a dragon. If you don't know what it is, it's the mythic. It's a 5/5 dragon with Dethrone. And when you attack for the first time each turn, if it's attacking the player with the most life, you get an additional untapped stat, or you get an additional combat phase, and you untap all your creatures. It's moved from $5 to $7 in the past couple weeks. The stock is pretty low on TCG Player. Dragon Commander is becoming a huge thing, obviously with Fate Reforged, and it's going to be even bigger with Dragons of Tarkir coming out. And in addition to that, dragons are obviously always been enormously popular at the kitchen table. And I mean, There's not a lot of conspiracy out there. There's certainly not a lot of mythics from conspiracy out there. This card is, I think, pretty primed to move pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. I really don't know if they're going to do another conspiracy and, like, reprint the same cards, or if they do all new cards. Like, we really don't know the reprint risk. We can kind of say, oh, it's probably pretty low, but there's no precedent for something like this. But what we can say now is, like, this card's moving. This card's a dragon. This card has a very good ability. These are all really positive signs. I'm not too bearish on this card, necessarily. So I think that's probably a pretty good pick.
Who else wants to jump on in with our pick of the week here?
Planeswalker cards should not be less than $5, right? Can we all agree on that?
Tibble?
Unless they're named Tibble.
Unless they're named Tibble. There is a Planeswalker that is headed below $5, and that is not correct.
Okay.
That Planeswalker's name is Duretti, Scrapper Savant.
What? Really?
Duretti is on his way down below $5. And you know what? Duretti is non-sane.
We go buy him
he
right
is
now.
A perfect... He's one of the least fair generals in EDH that we've seen. So the thing that Duretti has going against him is the fact that he was in a deck where every other card in the deck seemed more important when it first came out. Everyone's like, holy crap, this has got Wurmcoil Engine, and it's got Dual Caster Mage, and blah, blah, blah. And red was the most, like, the second most sought after deck after the white one, which had the Containment Priest that, like, hit $50 briefly. Like, everybody was all about this red deck, but nobody really cared about Duretti. So everyone just kind of, like, you know, it kind of suffered from the non-true name nemesis in the Mindseize deck syndrome that all those other cards suffered from. Duretti's a Planeswalker, and he's a damn good Planeswalker at that. Like, he should not be as cheap as he is. I think he could go cheaper. I think when his price starts to rebound, that's when you buy in. But I'm absolutely keeping my eye on the price of Duretti. Like, I'm checking him every 2 or 3 days. Because if he ever, like, approaches, like, four or even, like, God forbid, $3, he's insane. He's good enough to be a general. There is a moderate, like, reprint risk because he, you know, could be a good general, but I don't really see them reprinting him as, like, a judge foil or something like that. I think he's probably just going to be a really good card that, like, in a couple years, or, like, maybe 1 year to 18 months is going to really go up. Because if you look at the really good cards from Commander 2013, they're starting to look to tick up. So the first thing I noticed was that Primal Vigor was going up, and then I started to look at all the other good stuff from Commander 2013. That stuff's all ticking up, and that's about 18 months later. So I'm thinking, like, a year from now, the Commander 2014 stuff is going to start to tick up, and I think Duretti is a prime candidate for being, like, $10. So his price is absolutely incorrect right now, and it's going to be even more incorrecter later.
See, so that answered this question, guys. I was, I've been trying to get the red commander deck because it has a lot of great Q cards that I wanted to add in.
Sure does.
Already being one. Should I pick up these singles and just go for those, or should I still try to find the complete deck?
Oh, is it cost effective to buy the deck right now? Because it's got a worm coil. It's got a, do you want the dual caster for your cube?
Yeah, I want to do dual caster. The worm coil I'm not going to put in, but I want to have it because if I do put it in, I'll put
do
it
Do you
in.
Want scrap mastery? Like, it really depends what you want for the deck, because there's a lot
Duretti,
of stuff in
I
there.
I want the Duretti. I want the Felden. I want the dual caster. I want to get the worm coil. I want to use the goblin. What was it? The one drop guy?
Oh, the welder.
Yeah, goblin welder, yeah. God, that deck, you're right, man. That deck has so much good stuff in
it's
it.
It's got gas, man.
I guess the question is, I mean, did the commander sets sell the students? I mean, did they sell as well?
They sold more flat, meaning there wasn't consensus deck and then the rest of them kind of sat there, like, all but the blue one. Like, the blue one is consensus garbage pretty much. Like, if you go to any retail store, they've got, like, gobs of the blue one and all the rest are just, you know, gone.
But it did have Cyclonic Rift in it.
Yeah, so. That's it.
$30
It also had a bunch of stupid octopuses that no one cared about.
It's just hard to know how much of these they printed and how many people wanted them. Like, that's the thing with the commander sets, is it's really hard to know how much of them sell since they're aimed at a completely different audience.
I think you're going to pay less than $30 if you just buy the singles you want.
But is it we're going to see $20 commander decks like we did with the 2013 ones?
Oh, most certainly.
So I mean,
that's just wholesale of, like, that product in general. I think now is, like, any of them that aren't going to be super over, or, like, super underprinted. Like, the first series was the only ones that are going to hold that real value. You're certainly going to see them hit 20 before you see them hit 50.
Right. That sounds about right.
And I'll just wait for the 20. I think the $20 would be the better play than buying the singles.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, it's, we discussed a long time ago, the patience versus, you know, do you want the card now? How much is that tax worth being able to play for the, or pay, play with it for the next 6 months versus just waiting? Because this coming summer, you'll be able to find them on shops, shelves, and you'll be able to ask one of those shops, hey, I'll give you 20 for it, and they'll take it.
See, that's the benefit of Cube. You can not have certain components, and you got a fully functional Cube, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And as long as you're willing to play it like that, then that's a good move. I think that anytime you can wait on that kind of stuff, you're just doing yourself a service.
All right. So let's move into my pick of the week. I got several.
Ooh, hit us.
No, you get one.
No. I looked at one, and then I saw another one, and I saw another
one.
One
pick, nerd.
Hey, you can't use that.
So eloquent.
So the first one is going to be Mastery of the Unseen for paper. It already shot up in our moto. This was partially due to David Raging Gumby. He, in the SCG, he had some copies of this, and he was up to 200 life at one point. So this card is actually a pretty decent card for like control decks or grindy decks, which this standard looks like it can become. And paper is 30 cents. Online it shot up to $1, which means it's pretty significant. So I think there's opportunity in the paper that this can go up to be $1 card, maybe $1.50, maybe $2, but there's opportunity to get in right now while it's still cheap. Then for Moto, the other two cards are going to be Moto cards. One will be Temporal Trespass, which is the bad, was it the
bad time walk?
Yeah, the bad time walk, but it's like 44 cents. You can find it on Moto. You can find it even for like 39, which is really cheap. And the card, even though it's bad, there's still some potential that
mythic.
It could be played. Yeah, and it's a mythic for that price. I mean, there are bulk mythics that stay 40 cents and never see a dollar. And this has the potential to, but I still think that it could see marginal play and maybe be a $2 card or something. And there's some upside there. And just being a Delph card, there's potential that it could be broken. So I think that could be something to put a little bit of your tickets into and just wait it out. I think there's some chance there. And then also on Moto, there's 83 cents to get, Court of Calling, which I just think is, it was a, you know, $17, $20 card. Sure, that was when Birthing Pod was around, but this card has been proven to be very effective, and who knows if the Junks decks eventually adopt a Court of Calling, and at around 84 cents, I think you can get in there, and it's pretty safe.
Yeah, I like Court a lot.
Killing me, Marceau. Killing me.
Really?
You just completely wrecked my paper one.
Oh, but, you know, at least we let Marceau do 5 picks, so that's fair.
Hey.
No, I think it's fine. I mean, I think I have two anyway. The other one I was going to talk about is Master of Feasts. I think this is a card that's like just kind of fallen out of favor. Nobody really remembers it's in standard. And there are certain metagames where this card excels. Like, actually, the deck I'm playing around right now is based around like Whip of Erebos, Strength of, what is it called?
Strength of the Fallen.
And then just like a bunch of artifact creatures. And it's fun. But I think there's actually a show with Master of Feasts. The card's extremely hard to kill right now. Like, there's most decks are packed with 4 to maybe 6 ways to deal with that total.
I do like the card. And Sato, he just posted that mono black aggro deck where I think Master of Feasts might be able to fit slot in there somehow. Potentially. Is this?
Yeah.
It just is.
Absolutely.
It does so much damage. But it's in these control decks when you're playing against, say, a red-white control. Like, just giving them the extra card is, even though most of the removal can't probably deal with it until.
Right. They have to find a chain to the rocks. The big issue with it obviously being like, well, no, they have Valorous Stance too. That's the matchup it's worse against. But like, mono green, if you resolve this thing on turn 2 off of a mystic, you're like, mono green can't actually beat it. Every time I resolve it on turn 2, they just scoop. So. I mean, it has that going for it. And even versus the control matchups, like, they really only have 4 downfalls in their deck to deal with it, and maybe 1 silence. It's just not something that most of the time people are able to deal with. And But no, Court of Calling was going to be my actual paper pick.
Oh, nice.
Just because, like, I think Masters got a little while. It hasn't really found the home, and I don't think the metagame is 100% correct for it right this moment. But I expect both those cards, you know, shortly down the line to do good things.
Yeah, it's like 350 in paper, which is still pretty good. It's not nearly as great on as a Moto, but yeah, I think, yeah, even in paper, I think it's pretty decent. So I agree with you. And Master of Feats, another good thing going for it is from Journey of Nyx, which is that small set, which we're going to see that.
Yeah, there's lots of good stuff out of that. That set, over the next couple of years, I think it's just going to be really good once you factor in all the gods and stuff like that.
So someone asked on Twitter, they said, what do you guys feel about, say, getting these seal sets and just sitting on them, or getting foreign seal sets and sitting on them for several years? You think that's a good play?
Sealed sets of, like,
recent.
Like
Born of the Gods, I mean, whatever, Fate Reforged, or this Khans of Tarkir.
I think that sealed sets are getting harder and harder to be able to find this necessarily, like, value where you can, you know, guarantee that in 3 years this is going to be worth X amount. With the overprinting of comparatively to what it used to be, I think sealed sets are a little scarier to be devoting yourself to. But at the same time, they're always consistently going to make you money. Very rarely are they going to be worth less than they are, you know, when you buy them initially. And so usually the thing is to wait about a year after they come out. Like this summer would be the time that I would start focusing on Theros Block. And then after that point, I would sit on it for, you know, 2 to 3 years and hope that it would move and then, you know, push it. But I don't know that that's necessarily going to be the trajectory that it's going to that they're going to take anymore. Like, it all depends on, I guess, seeing how much of this overprinting, and I shouldn't call it overprinting, how much of the extra printing compared to what we used to see is really going to impact the price.
So we have some big news from Magic Online, or I guess it's big news because that's what Wizards is telling us. We got Tempest Remastered.
Do we think this is big news?
I do. I mean, it impacted the market heavily, but I don't know. I mean, it's going to be available for 3 weeks. And basically what this is going to take the entire Tempest block and then cut out X amount of cards, a few hundred. It's going to be a tight set of around 300 cards compared to what the whole block is.
This is FTV Wasteland.
Yeah. Well, basically, yeah, that's what it is. So you're going to have key cards. Main one, obviously, is Wasteland. And the big hot topic is Wasteland going to be at Mythic, or is it going to be rare? And is obviously
uncommon.
It's obviously not going to be uncommon.
Because it was uncommon before.
Yeah. Oh, good one. Good one, Jason.
Oh, well.
Refuted.
There you go. But they got now 15 mythics, and now they have to put into the slot of these new 15 mythics. They're going to have to rare shift stuff around to accommodate the set. And they're also going to make it a limited playable set. So they're going to cause, you know, cards to rare shift into there to balance out the limited format and create a good play set. So there's going to be obviously some reprints. You're going to see Mox Diamond. You're going to see
Mythic.
At Mythic, yes, most likely. I definitely see that at Mythic. You're going to see like City of Traders at Mythic.
Scroll at Mythic. I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah, I can see Silver Queen. I mean, you got Dream Halls. Yeah, not really Mythic-y. It's probably rare.
I don't know. Dream Halls was pretty brutal and limited.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Okay. If you were two colors, yeah.
Huh. Did not know that. Sure. It seems like active card disadvantage. But...
yeah.
Dream Halls. Corbin, you were 7 years old when Stronghold Draft was going on.
I mean, fair enough. But I'm with Marcel. It sure doesn't seem like it would be good.
Hey, I'm down to get proved wrong. I think Ensnaring Bridge is definitely going to be in there. You're going to have... Intuition's going to be in there. Humility is going to go there. So they're going to drop a lot of these expensive cards. Grindstone is definitely going to be in there. You'll see a Scroll Rack. But Wasteland.
Why would Grindstone be in there? To lower its price for.
Yeah, just
for
lower the price.
Online?
Yeah, just lower the price. Because it's a $12 card. And I mean, they're trying to. Obviously, this is kind of like opening up accessibility to Legacy because Wasteland was like approaching $130. Now it's selling for $62 and is down, I think closer to around 30 is where they want to hit it. Kind of like where Force of Will ended up after, Vintage Masters. Force of Will is still like around 25, I believe. So, I mean, this is what they need to do to make these legacy, to make legacy and vintage, playable on Magic Online. Like, you know, should import, or how you say that?
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah, that's $150. These are staples that they need to have that they didn't print in Vintage Masters, and expecting people to shell out this much for digital cards is a little outrageous. So at least they're doing some stuff here. You know, they're reprinting cards aggressively on Magic Online, something they might want to do in paper.
Well, I mean, they are Modern Masters 2, Modern Masters 1.
All right. But, I mean, they're making efforts, which is good. So
it's a lot easier to reprint stuff online at a moment's notice than it is in paper.
This is true. This is true. So, I mean, I commend Wizards for making this effort. It could be actually a very fun limited format. I'm not going to really draft too much because it's only going to be for 3 weeks, and I don't want to spend a lot of time learning to draft just so I could play a Wasteland lottery. Yeah, it doesn't seem like what I want to do, but I'm sure a lot of other people out there are going to have the time of their life doing this, and I'll buy the cards from them after they want to sell their Wastelands for cheap. There's not going to be opportunity if you want to get into playing some more Legacy or something and wait for this to happen to buy into some Wastelands, some Intuitions, and those other cards I was speaking on, and you can get them for the cheap and wait for later. So there's going to be financial opportunities for everyone one way or another, unless you don't play Magic Online, which is a great deal of people, because it's
in which case consider yourself lucky that you only have,
you know, you say that. I've started playing Magic Online in the last couple of weeks. It hasn't seemed so bad to me. Things seem to work pretty okay. I learned how to hold priority before I wrecked myself with Boom Bust. After I did that once, I learned I haven't had any events bug out. 2 weeks in, Magic Online seems okay to me.
The program's not that bad. It's really not. Like, I mean, it's sure. What it is the processes. There's a lot of things that they, like, when you have Ponder not working, when you try to fix some other cards, or the fact that you can't create a banned and restricted list by simply checkmarking some things and doing some unchecks, means that there's some faulty programming going on.
I think the base code they're working with is probably lacking. I think that probably accounts for a lot of the problems.
Yes. So that when you get under the hood, it may look good on the surface, and you kick the tires a little bit, and you can play the games. Like, I play Magic Online, and decent drafts are great, you know. The events will crash from time to time, but when you really just look at the potential and the glacial pace of where they're going, and when you really deal with trading, you're just like...
That all sounds probably like it's a problem.
Yeah, and just the downtime. Event downtime is by far the worst thing about Magic Online. At least when you go to a GP, you could talk to people, you could walk around, maybe do some trading, look at some booths, get some art assigns. Here, you gotta stare at your screen and make sure you're at your computer, so, cause God forbid you don't get to your seat in time and then all of a sudden you get dropped from an event. Leagues is obviously gonna change that. I got to play that on the beta, and Leagues changed the game for me for Magic Online, but they're gonna slowly roll it out. It's gonna be sealed, and then maybe drafted, and maybe constructed down the line. But the way that Worth, he did his State of the Union for Magic Online, and he just says, we're going to, you know, leagues are going to kick off, but we're going to be doing slow changes and no major changes for all of 2015, which I just personally think is unacceptable. Like, the Magic Online needs to move at a much faster pace, especially with Hearthstone doing as well as it is.
So what do they need to, I mean... Like, obviously, when events crash or things are bugged, stuff like that, that's clearly a problem, right? Mm-hmm. But besides that, what do they need to do to you? What are some of the major steps forward they can take?
Major steps forward would be other platforms that you could be on, where I think that they, like, iOS, you could have it on a tablet, is something they should work on. Maybe a web browser compatible type of program, or on Apple. Any one of those needs to be worked on. And they need to be moving forward in that direction. They're absolutely not moving any direction forward at all in any one of those, which I think is a big mistake.
Yeah, fair enough.
Another thing they should be trying to work on is maybe an open API where people could develop apps that interact with Magic Online, like, or even Apple, or even Wizards has their own official app where you can do off Magic Online on your phone. You could do some trading, or maybe even communicating with people inside the game so you can organize your friends and get your friends together so that you guys can play a game and, like, you know, community building. Like, that's something that's severely lacking for Magic Online is community aspect. And there's no, like, integration with social media, maybe Skype, or some way that you could facilitate trying to build a community on Magic Online is just very cold. So I think that needs to be there. And
fair
also
enough.
Streaming. Like, streaming is the biggest thing for Magic Online right now. And you can't do a game capture, a screen capture on there because of the way that they do the windows and everything. And it does not work well with the common streaming platforms. The fact that they're not trying to integrate with them is a huge mistake, and that should be something that they should be working on. Probably that's probably the biggest thing they should be working on.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, Hearthstone streaming's huge.
So, like, all these things, if they're trying to work on making this game stable, I commend you for that. But you're not thinking on the next level. You're just doing level zero shit. And, you know, like, that's basic-ass shit. Like Jason said, that's peasant shit. Money draft life. Get on our level, man. We don't want this shit. So, you know, we'll figure it out. Like I said, I still got that PowerPoint I'm going to do. I did my storyboard today, actually, or yesterday and today. So I wrote that out. I'm going to try to put it together and see what we can do to try to get some positive change, because I'm invested in Magic Online more than I should be. And, yeah, so I want to see success in the game, because it could be great. Sorry to talk so much. I don't talk much on this podcast. I get to do it this week. Cool.
Yeah, it was pretty lame.
So what you guys got to say before we get the fuck out of here?
We overshadowed Corbin and Jason this week, Marcel.
Yeah, huh? When the fuck does that happen? Like, really?
Never. Hey, man, I enjoyed it.
You guys talk about stuff that doesn't matter for a really long time.
Hey, it's like salty. Every other week for us.
Jason E. Salt.
No
God,
doubt.
That was an incredible nickname, Marcel.
Yeah, it was really original. You're a fucking genius.
I came up with that all by myself. I didn't get help from nobody else in this community at all.
I'd never heard it before. It was new to me.
Well, good. I'm glad you liked it. We're going to perpetuate that name. It's going to be the Jason
Corbin
Salt
Electricity's
Hour.
New to you.
See, this is how you can tell Jason Salty is getting defensive.
Indoor plumbing's new to Corbin, but...
So anything you guys want to say before we get out of here?
Yeah, like... The power supply in my computer is, like, hot to the touch, so I'd like to turn my computer off.
Okay.
I've actually already finished the show notes and submitted them, so I can shut my computer off and go to bed. So, yeah, like, I haven't used this computer in months, but, like, Brittany's laptop isn't working either, so I'm like, oh, shit, what do I do?
Yeah. All right, cool. All right, guys, well, I'm going to jump off then.
He'll just do his typical fade out.
Bye.
Jesus.
Good cast.
All right.
Good cast.
Later.
Later, nerds.
We can be found on GatheringMagic.com and BrainstormBrewery.com.